Apologies if I sort of overlook any points or questions that have been raised. I'm doing my best to respond. And I think, I mean, the first is if you address the unison question, I think it's important to recognise that those that were on the march on the 26th of March, the biggest contingent was made up of unison members. Yeah. And again, it's important to differentiate, I think a number of comrades made the point, to differentiate between some of the union leadership and their membership. I mean, this is a union leadership that's been witch hunting our comrades in London, and it has been at pains to stand in the way of strike submissions in local authorities, to block action, and yet, I don't know if anybody caught the quotes and the comments of Dave Prentice just prior to his annual delegate conference. I mean, it went from no action, we think we can cobble together a deal, to some of the most apocalyptic quotes I've heard. Certainly Dave Prentice, reference to the miners' strike, that one day strikes wouldn't be sufficient, that there needs to be a sustained rolling programme of industrial action. So again, you know, I think the moral of the story there being that if Dave Prentice feels the need to use language of that character, that is a real illustration of the huge pressure that's building up amongst his own members. Now, you know, there's some real pressures without dwelling on the point, there's some real tensions at the highest levels in unison about the way forward. I mean, there's a hard-line, pretty vicious right-wing element within the unison leadership that are, you know, the enemy is the enemy within, being the activists. And one of the things that holds them back from organising and working as closely with PCS and other unions is a fear that this will unleash forces way beyond their control that hopefully will sweep some of these characters out the way. So again, there's huge developments and pressures, you know, seismic, I think Dave used the term, was, you know, you could apply that to developments within unison as well. And it's not an even process. The action that was referred to in Southampton is jointly run by Unison and Unite. Again, that's just an illustration of where, I mean, to some extent the Unison leadership is a safety valve, but there are so many disputes now building up that, again, hopefully will reach a critical mass and that the pressure will force the Unison leadership to ballot in the autumn alongside PCS and many other unions. Now, I'll finish with reference to some of the points that Andrew made. I mean, I very much agree. I think that, you know, there's a sense now that socialist ideas go with the grain. I think, you know, you've got to go back a number of years where at times you felt that it was going against the grain, it was difficult, people were sort of earning enough to avoid some of the sharp political industrial questions that you can't avoid now. And it is an exciting time to be a socialist. I mean, there are huge struggles and battles unfolding, but I think, you know, the effrontery of the ruling class in the aftermath of the crash to then shift the burden onto workers through the scale of the attacks on public services, the rising unemployment, targeting the poorest and the vulnerable, this is not lost on workers, whether you're in or outside of a union. And I think, you know, the point that Andrew makes about political education, it was always a feature of militants, always a feature of the Socialist Party, that theory is not some abstract question, it's not just a good idea to have an interesting discussion. Again, you know, theory is your classic guide to action. And that's why it needs to be intrinsic to the way we organise as a party, that to consider our past, to, you know, have always a sense of perspective about what the problems have been in the past, exactly where we are now, and where we can things may develop in the future. I think that the comment that's made about the changed environment, you can see perhaps in PCS in a small way, you can see that in the RMT to an extent, that the question of leadership is absolutely vital. And this, I would portray this as what you're getting is it's largely from the ground up, as Andrew was saying. It is about a pressure that's developing in the different public sector unions But what we're able to do through PCS in particular is provide a sense of leadership that not just, you know, leaving it to the rank and file pressure against a reluctant bureaucracy, but by posing an alternative and saying, well, we're in favour of a collective, unified, sustained strategy of action, linking our work to building anti-cops groups in communities, building links across the public sector, and most importantly, building links with Unite. Again, this raises questions about what sort of leadership people want and deserve in other trade unions. I think it was Glyn made reference to Gove's comments about, I mean, this stunt of, you know, persuading teachers. And again, it is interesting. I think it's fascinating to see how that just completely fell flat, and absolutely no echo or resonance in response to that. And I think that there is a sense. I mean, I've tried to watch Question Time over the years, and I say tried to because I sort of gave up after a while because it was just the panel was, you know, Dimbleby's bad enough, but then the Mutual Admiration Society that with some strange celebrity sat on the end of it. You know, I mean, it just became unbearable. But the I would point to one. My general point is that it starts to become more palatable. Because in fact what you found is the audience, in the aftermath of the crash, the bailout to the banks, the bonuses paid, the attack on public services, the election of this government, the audience is well to the left on most issues of the panel. And even though I caught a little bit of the other night, and there was an alarming applause for John Redwood when he was attacking public sector pensions, but there was equally powerful applause for an attack, you know, on the banks and financial institutions for having caused this crisis and expecting working people to pay the price of this. So I do think, despite their best efforts, there is a huge groundswell of both understanding and political support growing all the time, not just amongst public sector workers, but the working class in general. Now, I think there was the reference, I think it was Katie that talked about, where they're talking about the turnout and how they're trying to misrepresent and suggest that we don't speak for our members. I mean, there was an interesting exchange on Channel 4 News between Mark Sawatka and Francis Maud, and this was, I think, last week. And what was intriguing about that is how irritable and, you know, belligerent Francis Maud was. Mark just patiently put the point that we're fighting to defend our members' conditions, it's us that are acting in the wider public interest. And Maud had a go at Mark Sawatka, saying you don't speak for your members, look at your 32% turnout. And Mark quite rightly made the point, and this needs to be part of our defence and our counter-argument, you have to remember who it is that introduced the balloting arrangements that produce a 30% and low turnout. It's postal balloting that was imposed by Margaret Thatcher in 1988, not to make unions more democratic, to increase the participation and therefore make the result more representative. This was about disconnecting the concept of trade unionism, voting as part of a workplace and part of a collective. It was about encouraging an almost armchair form of trade unionism, where you get your postal, you get your ballot papers at home, where there's a greater risk of it gets lost amongst the mail, where it's not a part and parcel of everyday trade union debate and activity. They knew what they were doing. When, I mean, there was the press conference that announced the 1988 employment law was, one of the speakers was Norman Tebbit. And Norman Tebbit actually made the comment, we've introduced these postal balloting arrangements because we're a bit concerned about voting that takes place. If we need to counteract the fact that people keep voting for left-wing leaders in the NUM, in the RNC, and in the CPSA. And it was a conscious, deliberate decision by the ruling class to introduce postal balloting. And Mark makes the point, okay, if you want to increase the turnout, then allow a return to workplace balloting that consistently shows a higher level of participation. What about online voting? You know, there's all sorts of ways and means. And again, it's important to expose the hypocrisy of these people who impose undemocratic mechanisms of voting in order to deliberately produce a lower turnout so they could discredit and denigrate the result. Now, I think that, I mean, reference was made to the Murdoch press, and I mean, no socialist or rational debate can take place without acknowledging the despicable nature. I was like Bill Hicks, I think it was, the comedian, who once said, if the Antichrist ever returns to Earth, it will come back in the form of an international media conglomeration. I mean, it is Murdoch's poisonous influence. You see the consequence of attacking the printing unions. It is an absolutely a vital element in the ruling class armoury in attacking the organised working class, attacking the confidence of the class in developing a class consciousness and a willingness to struggle. But again, it comes back to the point. The problem they have is a lot of workers will go, well, how can we ever win? You know, that they dominate the airwaves, they dominate the press, they pump out that message. You know, how do we get our message out? And I was, you know, the comment that the comrade made about, you know, the facts and figures, that what you can buy for $6 billion. Now, I mean, just to answer that, I mean, PCS has produced this pamphlet, which is an attempt to try and deal with some of these economic arguments. I mean, I'll be honest, it only skims the surface. And there's a huge amount of work. I mean, we're about to produce something in conjunction with Unite, and it comes back to the question that the comrade raised about, you know, we need to be clear about our economic arguments and about our alternative, including what are the, you know, detrimental economic consequences of the cuts in local communities and on economic activity. And again, all I can say is through our website, through the publications, through the work with other unions, that's going to be an absolutely crucial element. Not forgetting the important role through our paper and our own publications. But you're right, I mean, we need to marshal our arguments more effectively, promote them more effectively, use the means available, and there are increasing, of course, means that bypass the traditional, you know, communication methods. And again, unions are starting to wake up, I think, to the possibilities around all that. A number of comrades talked about, I think it was Katie, and then Mia at the end talked about the it's important when we talk about life expectancy. I mean, there's a quote here, this was in the Independent, and it said that the trade union officials keep banging on about bankers' bonuses and tax dodgers as if that's got any bearing whatsoever on the simple fact that in this country of 60 million people, life expectancy is racing ahead. I mean, the way they talk about it is if that's like a problem, that people are living longer, we should be ashamed of ourselves. Workers are actually living longer. And then it goes on to say, a teacher aged 65 in 1955 could expect to live to 76, while now it's 89. Yet pensions, wages and contribution rates have altered little over the intervening years. Again, I think, you know, this is just another illustration of the sheer class nature of the attacks that are taking place. And I think the crucial point when we talk about life expectancy is related to class. You know, I think Mia made the point, and that needs to be a crucial element in our counter-arguments against those that portray it as if it's a social problem that people are living longer. This surely is an opportunity. Surely this is a good sign of the way society is developing. But you would think, not. Now, I'll finish with the point about reference was made to organising the unemployed and young workers. And again, Youth Fight for Jobs has got an absolutely pivotal role to play. Anti-cuts groups rooted in communities have got a pivotal role to play. Trades councils, which we're seeing a resurgence in many parts of the country. I mean, some of them are a little bit stale, let me put it politely. I mean, I speak with somebody active in Blackpool Trades Council, you know, from the mid-70s, before I moved down with the union. But the fact is that you're seeing the development of all these community-based campaigns, and it's absolutely critical that we, you know, seek, unions should seek to organise the unemployed. We need to be talking about youth fight for jobs. We need to be talking about work unemployed centres. Again, you know, absolutely vital area of our area of work. And I just make an historical analogy that in the National Unemployed Workers Movement in the 30s, it was set up by the Communist Party. After the, you know, the 29 crash and the deep recession that took place, rising unemployment, it used to use this expression that the status of the man at the factory bench is determined by the status of the man at the factory gate. And again, it confirms that unemployed, this reserve army of labour, to use Marx's phrase, the unemployed are used to drive down conditions in the same way as the risk of offshoring to other parts of an increasingly globalised international market is used to drive down conditions here. So again, I think the party has got an absolutely vital role to play in orientating to unemployed workers, building genuine roots in communities. That's going to be the way that we build from the base upwards. Every successful working class organisation, from trade unions to political parties, has always been built from the base up, from the ground up, and it's about instilling and establishing our presence and organisation in every community. I think reference was made about, I think, and just to finish, I think on Dave's point about it is a sign of the times that a union like the ATL, or even PCS, we can track it back, reference was made that civil servants were some of the biggest strike breakers in 1926. You know, you've seen the more and more of what were called the white collar unions, unions that previously were described and perceived to be middle class institutions. Again, the sort of the working class nature of these organisations become increasingly increasingly clear, and it is a result of the seismic. To use Dave's phrase, the seismic changes that are taking place in British in British society. And I'll just finish with the final point that, you know, it is on an international scale. I'll give you two examples of what is possible, even from a PCS perspective. Two disputes recently. We organise workers on government contracts. This is work previously done in the civil service. We ran a dispute in Hewlett-Packard, biggest IT one of the biggest IT companies on the planet, non-union in the United States. We had 3-day strike action. I mean, the employer in the UK, amongst PCS workers, the employer almost perceived it as a close to mutiny. I mean, when we first said, well, we want to talk to you about pay rates, about collective bargaining rights, don't be silly, why would you listen to you? We accept that the workforce have the right to pay subscriptions, which is an acknowledgement of the fact that we'd be unlikely to win a UK contract if we didn't, but with no intention of engaging you properly. Confronted with the strike action, and one of our officials tells me that when management saw the level of support, they contacted PCS, were desperate to reach a settlement, but one of the other factors is that the UK chair of Hewlett-Packard had received at the dead of night a phone call from the chief executive of Hewlett-Packard in the United States, who phoned him off to say, I demand you settle this, because he'd seen in the San Francisco Advertiser reports of PCS workers taking industrial action. And again, that shows the truly global nature of the struggle. A similar development of a recent strike in Capita, one of the major government contractors, on the FTSE 100 index. Again, we've got workers organised in file stores in 3 northern bases. I mean, some of the most exploited and lowest paid sections on government contracts. We took 3-day strike action, members voted for further strike action. Again, the employer goes, we're not interested in talking to you. That serves you right for having a go at people, doesn't it? they treated us as almost mutineers. Why would we want to talk to you about establishing pay bargaining rights? But when they're confronted by literally hundreds of new members, more and more activists coming forward, support for the 3-day strike, a vote for further action. They came to us and said, look, we'll reach a deal. We'll cost the introduction of the UK equivalent of the London Living Wage. We're prepared to pay that, we'll cost it, and we'll agree with you some pay bargaining rights. But here's the amusing element to this. They also said, we're a bit worried that if we're going to be bidding for all of these government contracts in the outsourcing bonanza, as it's been described, we're a bit worried if we pay a living wage to our workers, what about the other companies? And we want a commitment from PCS that you'll put those other companies under exactly the same pressure as you have us. And we've got to meet them. That's the type of assurance all trade unions and socialists want to give to employers. And we've got a meeting coming up in a couple of weeks with their chief executive in Capita, the one who coined the phrase outsourcing bonanza, to convince him that not only do we want you to cost and pay the UK living wage, we will be applying the same pressure alongside a joint campaign with Unite, I should hasten to add, all of these companies, your Fujitsu's, your Siemens, Mighty, all of these companies that are hovering around the edges waiting to bid for government contracts. I simply mention that as an illustration, but don't let anybody tell us it's too difficult to organise private sector workers. Don't let anybody tell us that these institutions are too powerful and we can't make a difference. And again, out of struggle will come the confidence, out of struggle with an increasing orientation and thirst for politics. And again, the party is well placed, I think, to provide that socialist alternative and to be the catalyst for developing the political socialist working class alternative that Britain needs to accompany the growing industrial struggles.